It's a place of welcome, a place of peace. A place for us to be ourselves. And now look.
It's Monday, November 21st, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. In a few minutes, we'll dig into the international climate agreement that world leaders struck over the weekend. And we'll talk to Jerry Seinfeld, who's out with a new book based on his show, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. But first, that was Joshua Thurman we heard a moment ago. He was at Club Q in Colorado Springs Saturday night when a gunman opened fire, killing at least five people. As Thurman told reporters yesterday, the club was a haven for LGBTQ people in the area. And now people across the country are mourning the victims of another mass shooting targeting the LGBTQ community. Deepa Fernandez spoke earlier with Colorado State Representative Leslie Herod. In 2016, Herod became the first LGBTQ African American ever elected to the state's General Assembly.
Tell us what went through your head and your heart when you first heard the reports about this mass shooting.
Yeah. Well, I was awoken in the morning to the news of the shooting in my hometown of Colorado Springs, just an hour outside of Denver, a place where people gathered who were LGBTQ like me and allies and champions, just to feel community, just to feel connection. I have myself been to Club Q many a times when visiting family in Colorado Springs, and it is unthinkable. Unmentionable what happened. It's such a tragedy, and my heart was just breaking. But I got to tell you, after the initial heartbreak and reeling from the shock, I'm pretty upset. I'm infuriated that once again, our community in Colorado has been targeted by gun violence and hate. This should never happen. It should never happen. And it happened on Transgender Day of Remembrance to a community that's full of love, full of support. And now we're mourning.
And this place, Club Q, been reading about it. Tell us what it represented to the LGBTQ community in Colorado Springs.
Oh, it's a place of celebration. I mean, it's a place where people can go who are queer, who've been told that they're different and they're outsiders, a place they can go and feel like they're part of a community, a place they can go, we can go, and feel safe, and supported. And it's a community full of love.
And that's so important. A study last year found that the LGBTQ community in Colorado Springs lacks physical, mental, and sexual health services.
Yeah.
Just paint a picture of what it's like in that community if you are LGBTQ.
Well, I want to say that the Colorado Springs community is not a hateful community. I don't want to paint a broad brush across all of the Springs, a place where I was raised and I was embraced and loved. But there is a lot of hate that does happen. A lot of the leaders down in Colorado Springs, whether it be elected leaders or religious institutions like Focus on the Family, have consistently degraded and dehumanized LGBTQ people and our families. And so there is a feeling of not being safe there and wanting to look for places where you don't have to wonder if someone supports you, but you know they do. And that's what Club Q is. I mean, it's a place where you can walk in and just know that the person smiling at you, you know, behind the bar is truly smiling at you and seeing you for who you are, as opposed to maybe, you know, not being sure if you go to the grocery store if you're going to be supported and embraced by someone who's on the in the line with you. That's the kind of uneasy feeling that is brought in places like Colorado Springs and other conservative areas where we know in our hearts the majority of the people are supportive. The majority of the people are not homophobic, are not transphobic, but the likelihood of running into someone who is and who is does have hatred directed towards you, that's also increased.
Focus on the Family, which you mentioned, is a conservative Christian ministry, which is based there in Colorado Springs. The accused gunman was known to police for bomb threat last year. Colorado also has a red flag law where police can take away guns from someone deemed dangerous, but that's really rarely used in Colorado, which has been home to many mass shootings, unfortunately. What has to change?
Well, it's about enforcement of the law. you know, the legislature, you know, and I was a co-sponsor of those, of that bill. The legislature said that we want to end gun violence in our communities, that we must enact sensible gun reform. And we did. We passed red flag laws. But consistently, we've had law enforcement in some of our communities say we will never enforce it. And in fact, in Colorado Springs, which is one of the largest cities in Colorado, there are folks who have said in law enforcement that we will not enforce the red flag law, we'll never use the red flag law. And we saw that happen with this exact tragedy. The red flag law could have stopped the murder of five people and the harming of so many others. It could have helped and stopped this tragedy, and it was not used.
Leslie Hurd is a state representative in Colorado. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up next, 2 weeks of climate negotiations have wrapped up in Egypt. Activists see some things to celebrate and plenty more to work on. What's in the deal from COP27 after the break? The UN climate negotiations in Egypt went into overtime Friday night, but eventually ended with a breakthrough on a key issue. World leaders agreed to set up a fund to compensate poor countries for the loss and damage they're suffering from climate change. But the summit did little to cut future emissions, and many criticized the final deal for failing to commit to phase out fossil fuels. Deepa checked in with Alden Meyer for some analysis on what it all means. He's senior associate at the climate change think tank E3G, and he called the Loss and Damage Fund an historic victory.
This has been on the agenda for 30 years, and developed countries, especially the United States, have resisted creating this fund, so that was historic. But we really had a setback on mitigation of climate emissions and keeping the 1.5 Celsius temperature goal alive. The fossil fuel countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and others joined with China and other countries to block progress on that front.
Okay, and we want to talk about both of these. Let's start with the Loss and Damage Fund. As you said, it was a triumph, 30 years coming. So tell us briefly what it is and how it will help the climate.
Well, what's involved here is exploring ways to generate a lot more money to go help countries like Pakistan, the small island states, others that are already damaged by climate impacts to deal with those impacts. And it has been a long time in coming, and there's still more work to do. They have to define exactly how it will work, who will be on the hook to contribute to the fund, and most importantly, how to identify innovative sources of finance that can generate the tens of billions of dollars a year that are going to be needed without taking money away from mitigation and adaptation. That's the trick.
And as you mentioned, the United States has always been one of the holdout countries, fearing it would just have to pay huge amounts as one of the biggest historical emitters of emissions. What made the U.S. delegation sign on this time?
Well, the U.S., by the end of the 2 weeks, was totally isolated once the European Union and other developed countries moved to say they could accept establishment of such a fund. The U.S. realized that it had to fall into line. And so at the end of the day, we have this fund, but now the U.S. really needs to step up in supporting getting it up and running and helping identify how to drive money into it. And that's going to be the next step.
Okay, so that's the good news. The not so good news is that there was no agreement on some of the issues like keeping warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Let's take a quick listen to COP26, Alok Sharma, in his closing statement.
A clear commitment to phase out all fossil fuels, not in this text, and the energy text weakened in the final minutes. Friends, I said in Glasgow that the pulse of 1.5 degrees was weak. Unfortunately, it remains on life support.
What are your thoughts on where COP27 failed?
Well, I think Alok Sharma had it exactly right. Petrostates led by Saudi Arabia and Iran, joining with some of the big emerging economies such as China, blocked any effort to strengthen language in the final agreement to deal with the root cause of the problem, which is fossil fuel emissions. India put forward a proposal to expand the phase-down language of coal from Glasgow last year to include oil and gas. That was blocked, and the Egyptian presidency contributed to that by refusing to put any language in the text acknowledging the need to phase down all fossil fuel emissions, even though a majority of the world's countries had asked them to do so. So that was a big step backwards, and we're going to have to keep fighting to make improvements on that as we go to the next COP in Dubai next year.
Did it go beyond what was promised last year in Glasgow in any ways?
Well, there were a couple of bright spots. We did get an explicit mention of the need to ramp up renewables deployment, which is important. We also got some language in there urging the World Bank and other multilateral development banks to step up to the plate when it comes to financing the decarbonization of developing countries. So there were a couple of bright spots, again, hooks to build on, but it just demonstrates the power of Saudi Arabia and the other blockers in this process to keep real progress from happening.
We've also heard Greta Thunberg and other activists call the COP conferences greenwashing events. What are you hearing from activists after this COP?
Well, I think there's incredible frustration of the lack of progress towards ramping down emissions, as is needed to prevent even worse impacts of climate change in the future. There's a lot of people saying this process is broken. The reality is the process isn't broken. It's the power of individual countries that want to block progress. That's the issue here. And so we need to keep working this process, but I think we also need to look outside at other spaces like the G20 and other places where countries come together to try to make progress on this issue in the year ahead.
Alden Meyer, Senior Associate Climate Change Think Tank E3G. Thank you so much, Alden.
Thanks. I enjoy being with you.
After the break, comedians in cars getting coffee, meet public radio personalities on podcasts doing interviews. Robin Young talks to Jerry Seinfeld. Stick around.
We all know Jerry Seinfeld starred in the sitcom Seinfeld, which was about nothing. Then in 2012, he created a reality show.
Hi, I'm Jerry Seinfeld, and this is Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
And as you can hear, as I tried to get through my formal introduction in our recent talk, viewers also didn't know what that show was about. We all said, what? What is that? Much like the show Seinfeld, it purported to be about nothing. Just for 10 years, Jerry Seinfeld asking fellow comedians to simply get in a car and get coffee while we listened. And it was never just a cup of coffee. It was a sacred, sensual ritual, loving shots of brew dripping into the pot. What is that making up for, Jerry Seinfeld? So much for my formal introduction. Jerry Seinfeld's new book includes transcripts of the show, conversations that are hilarious and intimate. Here's Jerry and Amy Schumer.
What's really hard for you?
I know for female comics, it's hard to date someone. It's usually an issue what we do.
Do you think female cops have the same problem?
I do think that.
I don't think it's harder to do the job.
It's everything else.
It's everything else.
Yeah.
The book celebrates the 10th anniversary of the show. It's what else? A large coffee table book. It's called The Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee Book. And here's our conversation. And Jerry, I'm thinking you could have named it The Comedians in a Car Getting Coffee Table Book.
Obviously, Robin, I thought of that.
And
dismissed it because I didn't want to tread on Kramer's coffee table coffee book, that the coffee table book that becomes a coffee table.
That's right.
See, the beauty of my book is if you don't have a coffee table, it turns into a coffee table.
Jumping in to say that's Michael Richards as Kramer debuting his coffee table book on the Regis and Kathy Lee show within a Seinfeld episode. In real life, by the way, it did have table legs and it sold quite well, as Jerry reminded me.
That fell into the category. I think we did that joke already.
That's right. Sorry.
That's all right.
But as I said, when the show Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee first debuted, people were saying, what is this? And you start your introduction in the new coffee table book by saying, I almost feel like I should apologize for this idea I had. Why?
Well, it just seemed a little indulgent. All the late night talk shows, I pretty much only am waiting for the comedian to come on. So I thought, well, what if there's a show where that's the only guest that they have? And they can say things that the audience doesn't go, whoa, you know, and kind of interrupt what is heading towards maybe something a little subtle or a little personal. You cannot put a comedian in front of an audience and ask him to not service that audience. They won't do it.
But what did you want to say about comedians? You know, you say they're the closest things to inanimate objects. They're not part of this terrestrial world. They move like an alien spaceship. So here you are in your spaceship in a car. Right. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if I play you the unedited footage of two comedians talking, nobody moves faster through subjects. Comedians never say, whoa, where did that come from? They're there. They're on hyperdrive. That's what a stand-up set is. It's a condensed, hyperkinetic, fake conversation. Nobody talks in a series of jokes. It's a ridiculous conceit that is happens to be a lot of fun, but it takes a tremendous amount of work to create it. But the comedian brain that can do that is not a typical brain.
Yeah. So, for instance, Jim Carrey talks about a gig where he was a cockroach running around trying to avoid a vacuum cleaner, and your response is, yeah, yeah.
Right. Makes perfect sense. Yeah, that's logical.
Yeah. And each show begins with a phone call to the comic, and here's the one that begins your episode with the late, marvelous Gary Shandling. Let's listen.
Gary?
Oh, Jerry.
When do we do the phone call that would be on air?
Now. We're doing it now.
Oh, my God. I haven't talked to you in so long. I can't wait to see you. And you edit, right? Because everything in my life needs to be edited.
Well, everything in your life comes after a 19-second pause.
I don't know why you say that.
We can hear how dear friends you were.
Mm-hmm.
Were they all dear friends?
No, a lot. Many of these people I had never met before. Amy Schumer, I had never met before.
Really?
Steve Martin, maybe I met him.
No, wait. We think of you rooming together. We think of you in comedy dorm, no?
Well, that's the thing that I discovered doing the show is any comedian sits down with any other comedian and you feel like you grew up together.
I remember once when I was starting out, I was playing a club called the Ice House. About halfway through my 25-minute show, and I realized that I had not gotten one laugh. And I thought, why not go for the record?
25 clean.
You know, if you're a comedian, your whole life is completely artificial except for the comedy. The comedy is the only real thing to you. Everything else, you're just kind of trying to act normal so people don't realize how off you are. I was at a dinner the other night with Steve Martin and Seth Meyers and John Mulaney and our wives. Somebody heard there's this new Chinese restaurant in town. Oh, why don't we make a date that we can all go to this Chinese restaurant? And I think it was Seth Meyers' wife said, with these autistic men, we're going to go out?
No offense to people on the spectrum.
No offense. You can ask my wife what it was like, how much I had to learn how to do to function. You know, things that I had never needed to learn before because I didn't have a normal social world that I lived in.
Hmm. Can you give us an example?
I had to walk into a room of people and there's no comedian to talk to.
What was it like to sit in the living room with Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks? You start in this conversation I'm looking at, hey, can we get back to Get Smart? Because that was another show that changed my life. And Carl says, oh, he played it here last night. I mean, what was it like to be in their presence?
For me, that's a religious moment. Can you imagine meeting Moses, you know?
Although instead of a tablet, Mel came up with the shoe phone.
Right,
Get
the
Smart.
Shoe phone. Right. Mel and Carl, Jerry Lewis, Don Rickles. I love my contemporaries, but it's the older guys I love the most.
Yeah.
Because people ask, what's it like to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson? I used to say, it's like there's a doorknob on the front of your TV and you just opened it and stepped inside.
Yeah. I love that somebody, I can't remember who, said that Red Skelton, it might have been Michael Richards, who said
that. Yes, it was. He loves Red Skelton.
Red Skelton was his hero. And one day, Red Skelton was the audience and he signaled to him to stand up and be recognized. And instead, he stood up and did an hour.
Yeah, right.
Well, speaking of Michael Richards, sometimes these conversations read like therapy, mm-hmm. you know, you each helping each other. And we all know mm-hmm. that your mm-hmm. former Seinfeld castmate, you know, had a huge controversy in 2006, a video of him going on a pretty racist tirade against a heckler, mm-hmm. Went viral. He retired from stand-up in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to you, like, I made a mistake. You know, I was concentrating on myself, my ego. And, you know, you had the conversation about the incident. By the way, did you ever think of not talking to him because of that?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I'm not minimizing what happened, but how could you not understand a mistake? I mean, every comedian knows what it's like to be up there in that frying pan, and it's very easy to lose your equilibrium and make a terrible mistake. I've offered to have fistfights with audience members. I said, let's go outside right now and sort this out. Mm-hmm. The thing I remember most, actually, from that conversation, we were talking about the series, and he said, gee, I wish I would have enjoyed it more. And I said, that wasn't our job to enjoy it. It was our job for them to enjoy it.
Well, I think we have a little bit about that.
Okay.
It's always a struggle with me.
No. I don't accept the judging of process. It doesn't matter that you like to rehearse with your nose up against the flat saying lines. That doesn't matter.
You used to see me back there doing
yes.
that, huh?
We're all trying to get to the same island. Whether you swim, fly, surf, or skydive in, it doesn't matter. What matters is when the red light comes on.
Okay.
Well, you say in the introduction that the book is a Valentine, really. Maybe mm-hmm. the show was too?
Yes, absolutely.
Because why?
When you suddenly find yourself in the group of people that have the same thing as you, you feel at home for the first time in your life. You've always felt, I don't belong here. And for the first time, you walk into a club and there's all these comedians standing at the bar and you feel like, oh, this is where I belong. That feeling that's a life moment. That gives you a life. I didn't know what I was here for. Now I know. Those friendships are what I wanted to show. I wanted to show there's a quality to these friendships. There's something about them that's just different. It always starts the same way. You're like in second grade or third grade, and you're the funny kid in the class, you know. And then you find another funny kid, and it's like there we are. We're like two rhesus monkeys. They just grab each other, you know. And it stays like that your whole life. You just walk in the room, and if you're a comedian, you see another comedian, you just run over to him.
Yeah. That's Jerry Seinfeld. His new coffee table book is The Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee Book. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, for more stories. Today, we've got the latest on the war in Ukraine and the freight rail labor negotiations here in the U.S. And we look at Dave Chappelle's recent appearance on SNL and the backlash NPR TV critic Eric Deggans got when he criticized the comedian's handling of the controversy surrounding Kanye West.
It was tough to figure out exactly what he was saying. I think he did that on purpose so that his fans could defend him and say he wasn't minimizing anti-Semitism, although there were many points in that monologue where he seemed to be doing exactly that.
Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Hafsa Qureshi, and Emiko Tamagawa. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Technical direction today from Caleb Green and Max Liebman. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.